We continue our series of homilies on life, and I want to talk about those issues that deal with life after birth until a person dies, that is, in that middle time period. And there's a number of them, and the first one, of course, is infanticide. It was common in certain ancient cultures, and even in some cultures they used to sacrifice children. But in our culture, it's becoming more predominant because of the fact that with abortion, you know, you hear stories about girls having their kids and then throwing them in dumpsters, or you hear about, you know, children being born alive in an abortion clinic and they just either strangle it or they let the thing die, etc. So there is, infanticide is actually part of our culture as well. It is also a fact that it's the byproduct or the proper effect of a certain kind of thinking. If the conjugal act is severed from its primary end, which is to have children, and the reason people have it is purely for pleasure, then what happens is, which is an integral part of the spirit of fornication, which is, I find somewhat interesting, that in a time when fornication is such a problem, is the time in which the church and the new rite dropped it from its litany of saints. But the point being is that if you have the spirit of fornication within a culture, and its primary end is pleasure, then what happens is that you don't want to have kids. Why? Because kids are unpleasant to a certain degree. I mean, they're also very joyful things, etc., and they can be get a great deal of fulfillment and satisfaction to the parents, but they're also, they can be an inconvenience and things of this sort. Well, that's contrary to the pleasure. So if you've adopted that pleasure principle, which is integral to the spirit of fornication, then you're going to have contraceptions, you don't want to have kids. And then if that's the case, then if that fails, then you actually have to have abortion. But then after the abortion, then if that doesn't work or whatever the case is, then you have infanticide. But since you don't want to, engendered in all of that, of course, then is the, just the germs, you don't want any kind of inconvenience. And that means mommy and daddy, when they get to a certain age, because they become an inconvenience, you have to just basically get rid of them. So once you've adopted the spirit of fornication in a culture, it is impossible by the sheer logic of the principle that's adopted. It will drag you, whether you like it or not, to the conclusion that that euthanasia is okay, abortion is okay, infanticide is okay, all these things are okay, or even getting rid of certain people that, you know, who don't have the same quality of life that are quite up to our standards. That actually brings up a particular point. You know, one of the things they're doing is selective abortion, where they check, and if a kid has genetic anomalies, they just abort the kid. But what people fail to realize is that, well, let me just put it this way, that's a Marxist mentality. If you're not a productive individual in society, and by productive they mean that you actually can contribute to the bottom line in the society, then really you're just a burden to society and you need to get rid of it. But in point in fact, some of the handicapped, or the people that suffer from certain difficulties of quality of life or retardation, what have you, are in fact the most significant and important people in a culture because of the fact that they become the means by which other people attain virtues that they would not otherwise attain. They're the people that require in a culture a certain moderation and temperance, a lack of cruelty, a certain mercy, and a certain compassion. They're the ones who actually require out of people things that otherwise just wouldn't come about. And so what they teach a particular culture is that the value of human life transcends the particular quality of the difficulties a person suffers, and that what a person contributes to the society is not merely monetary, but in point in fact, a contribution to a society and its virtue is a higher contribution than the money. So in a certain sense, they're even more productive than other people. Then, of course, there is the difficulty with suicide. And this is the real problem with euthanasia, which we'll talk about in the next homily. But suicide is one of those things that because it affects the common good and is therefore against the living in a society, it's actually contrary to the third category of natural inclination. It is, of course, against the first category of natural inclination, that is, to preserve our being as it is. And so this is one of the reasons why the church always considered it morally sinful. But we also have to realize that when people commit suicide, in a vast majority of the cases, at least in my estimation, people don't do it with full voluntariness. They're not really fully grasping the impact or the effects or even what they're doing. And so we have to have a certain level of understanding about people who do that, recognizing that we have to commend them to the mercy of God, and to pray that anything that any culpability on their part is comes under the mercy of God. But it's one of those things that it affects, because it's the suicide is becoming, it's, even though it does exist elsewhere, it's becoming more and more of a problem among the elderly, and that's something that we'll see. Then, of course, there's mutilation without a sufficient reason. And you think, well, why would you, people think of mutilation and hacking off their limbs and things of that sort. But there's other forms of mutilation, like tattooing, which I mentioned before. It's just a form of mutilation. It's a form of body modification. And this is generally considered grave matter. Mutilation is in the category of grave matter. It falls against a sin against the fifth commandment. So that tattooing is always considered a sin against the fifth commandment. Sometimes it's a sin against the first commandment if it contains things that are bad. Again, I can't ever understand why someone who's 18 would go off and get a tattoo of the kind of which nobody who's 60 or 70 years of age would even think of having on their body, because eventually that's what's going to happen. You know, I don't know if you ever saw the commercial. I think it was, I don't know if it was an American Express or Visa commercial, but the guy, he goes with his girlfriend to the tattoo parlor, and his girlfriend name is Donna, so he decides he's going to get Donna put on his arm there, and he runs out of money, so the guy stops at Dawn. So the, you know, the moral of the story is that this is, you know, don't do something that you're not willing to be stuck with the rest of your life. And even then, the tattooing, there's only one instance that I know of that moralists say it may be justified, and that is if you have a soldier who has to go to war and he's going into a situation where you only want to leave a very small identification on him by means of the tattooing. They say that might be a justified reason. Other than that, it's not considered legitimate. There are certain kinds of corrective tattooings, like if people have facial anomalies, they can do kind of tattooing to kind of remove that. That's trying to restore the order of nature. That would be considered legitimate. But this would also include plastic surgeries without a sufficient reason. Now, there are certain plastic surgeries which are trying to restore the order of nature, and therefore it's in congruity with the natural law, and those are justified, but there's some that aren't. I could never quite understand, you know, you look at these Hollywood people, and it looks like someone just grabbed the top of their head and grabbed the skin and just pulled their skin tight, because they're just like, you're just like, how is that beautification? But then, of course, there's also other forms of plastic surgery, too, that are completely unjustified. I tell people, only in the United States, in our culture, could someone start out a black man and at the time of his death look like a white woman. You know, it's just like there's something fundamentally wrong. And actually, they know that there's a psychological disorder where people enjoy getting cut. They enjoy the plastic surgeries because there's a certain high that they get out of it. And that's a sign that there's a real disorder in that. Mutilation is contrary to the virtue of truthfulness. That is, getting tattooing and things like that, that's not your proper body color. That's not what's supposed to be there. So it's actually contrary to the virtue of truthfulness. And this means then, of course, that you actually have to recognize that it's against the third category of natural inclination, that is, living in society and things like that. Sometimes, too, people's tattooing is so unsightly, you're just like, look, why don't you cover it and do us all a favor? But then, of course, there is the problem of just truthfulness about, and this is just basic honesty, of looking your age and even your gender. I mean, you know, as far as looking your age, you know, some of these people, you know, they get to 60 and they just want to look like they're 24. And you're just like, why? You're 60. You're entitled to sag a bit, you know, in your face and things like that. So why are you worrying about it? Age gracefully. Then, of course, there's the problem of transgender operation, which is just a form of mutilation. And it's a form of mutilation because genetically, you don't change a person genetically. You're just mutilating them in certain bodily organs in order to make them look like a particular gender. In fact, the medical community, if you look at the definition of it in some of the medical books, they actually refer to it as simulation of the opposite gender. So it's not a true change. And this is contrary to living in society. One time a priest came to me, he was asking me what he should do about this one particular individual who has started the procedure to go through that gender change, and they were like halfway betwixt between, and it looked like a man, but there was other aspects that looked like a woman. He's just like, well, what do I do when it, he kept referring to it, when it comes to the communion rail? And he just said, you've got to sit him down and just say, you have to stop the procedures. You've got to reverse it if you've got the financial means. And you've got to stop this nonsense. Otherwise, you can't come to communion. This is grave matter here. People sitting there saying, I'm a man in a woman's body. That is absolute nonsense. Gender is not in the soul. I don't care what Peter Kreeft says. I don't care what these people say. The philosophers have worked it out very well. Gender is in the body. What they fail to recognize is that the soul the operations of the soul are adjusted according to the disposition of the body. And what that means is that the DNA structure, as soon as the person is conceived, it's either male or female, barring certain other anomalies, but it's male or female. And so the soul, the augmentative power, the operations of the soul are according to the dispositions of the body. It means that as soon as it sees that DNA, or operates through that DNA, then what it does is that it actually develops by its augmentative power, which we talked about in the last homily, to the trajectory of developing the person according to a particular gender. God and angels have no gender because they don't reproduce in that fashion. While we refer to them in the masculine, and this is proper theologically because of the fact that they're more akin to certain male aspects, namely power and strength and that type of thing, nevertheless, they don't have a gender. So when people say, I'm a man in a woman's body, that's just absolute nonsense. Your body is who you are. It's part of you. Okay. Then, of course, there is another aspect, which is vaccinations derived from fetal tissue. And this has become a particular difficulty. All the fetal tissue that's done in order to derive that, they have an obligation to return it to its owner, which I talked about in the last homily. That is, to God by proper burial. They can no longer use those lines. But these cell lines that are often used to derive the vaccinations, because they're from aborted fetuses, it constitutes an immoral situation. In moral theology, there are three things that constitute every moral act. The first is called the end. Why are you doing it? You know, you ask your son, why are you hitting your sister? Because I don't like her. Okay, so there's that. The second reason is what they call the object. That's the action you're performing. It's the hitting, right? Then there is the circumstances in which it's done. So if he hits her in front of her friends to make her feel bad and embarrassed, you know, that makes it worse, right? Those are the circumstances. Well, there is what they call the pseudo-Dionysian principle of the integral good. Don't worry, there's not an exam. You're not going to have to remember that phrase. But the principle basically states that the good is from an integral cause and evil from any defect whatsoever. That means if any of these three, the intention, the action, or the circumstances is bad, the entire action you're performing is rendered bad in the process. Now, why is this important in the context of the discussion of vaccinations derived from aborted fetal tissue? Well, it's because of this. There's a circumstance called quibus auxilis in Latin. It's roughly translated as by what aid. So, for example, if you kill somebody and you do it by torture, water torture, that's the aid that you're using. The water is the torture. That's the aid. Or a gun is an aid. All right. It can increase or decrease the gravity of the action, or it can even render it entirely bad. In this particular case, the fact that you're getting a vaccination, which can or may not be a good idea, getting a vaccination by means of using that's derived from abortive fetal tissue violates the pseudo-Dionysian principle of good. That is, you're using a fetal tissue that is gained by an immoral means, and that aid by which you're vaccinating is constitutes the immorality. And so to get vaccinations derived from fetal tissue is in fact immoral. Now, there are other vaccinations out there that derive from other things, and therefore you don't have to do that. And a lot of times if you just ask your doctor, ask around, you can get it. It's not an issue. There's also a real question, because people will come to me and say, do I have to get my kids vaccinated? And I said, well, not necessarily. The church just says you have to take reasonable care of the health of your children. That's all it says. Now, and that means that it's more contextual. It seems to me if you're talking about a major epidemic outbreak, it might be a good idea to get it. But they also know that they do think that there is a connection between the mercury levels in vaccines and a variety of other things and autism, increase in autism and things of that sort. I also think it's problematic that you're introducing a pathogen into your body without a sufficient reason very often. If there's not an outbreak, why is everybody doing it? So the point is, in all of this, is that people need to give the consideration to that, you know, give sufficient consideration to it. The fact that it's just in our culture where everybody just gets vaccinated, it doesn't mean that that's why you should go off and do it. I think there has to be legitimate consideration given to it. On the other hand, if there's an epidemic or an outbreak and you don't do it, I think that's cause for imprudence. I mean, I think that's just real imprudence. In the next homily, we'll take up end-of-life issues. In the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost.